the time and the place.
As our first story begins, in 1803, Washington was no more than a raw country village. In the unfinished capital sat the Senate of the United States, already vastly different from that very first Senate which had sat in the old New York City Hall in 1789, and even more different from the body originally planned by the makers of the Constitution in 1787. The Founding Fathers' concept of the Senate, in contrast to the House, was of a body which would not be subject to constituent pressures. Each state, regardless of size and population, was to have the same number of senators.
Senators were not to be elected by popular vote. The state legislatures, which could be relied upon to represent the conservative property interests of each state, were assigned that function. In this way, said Delegate John Dickinson to the Constitutional Convention, the Senate would consist of the most distinguished characters, distinguished for their rank in life and their weight of property, and bearing as strong a likeness to the British House of Lords as possible. Moreover, the Senate was to be less of a legislative body, where heated debates on vital issues would be followed anxiously by the public, and more of an executive council, passing on appointments and treaties and generally advising the president without public galleries or even a journal of its own proceedings. The original 22 United States senators meeting in New York in 1789 at first seemed to fulfill the expectations of the makers of the Constitution. The Senate, as compared with the House of Representatives, was on the whole far more pompous and formal, its chambers far more elaborate, and its members far more concerned with the elegance of dress and social rank. Although senators were paid in the munificent sum of $6 per day, and their privileges included the use of great silver snuff boxes on the Senate floor, the aristocratic manners which had characterized the first Senate were strangely out of place when the struggling hamlet of Washington became the capital city in 1800, for its rugged surroundings contrasted sharply with those enjoyed at the temporary capitals in New York and Philadelphia. John Quincy Adams noted in his diary that some of his colleagues' speeches were so wild and so bluntly expressed as to be explained only by recognizing that the member was inflamed by drink. But certainly the Senate retained greater dignity than the House, where members might sit with hat on head and feet on desk, watching John Randolph of Roanoke stride in wearing silver spurs, followed by a foxhound which slept beneath his desk, and calling to the doorkeeper for more liquor as he launched vicious attacks upon his opponents. Nevertheless, the House, still small enough to be a truly deliberative body, overshadowed the Senate in terms of political power during the first three decades of our government. But as the Senate shed its role as executive council and entered on a more equal basis with the House into the legislative process, it also became apparent that no constitutional safeguards, however nobly created, could prevent political and constituent pressures from entering deliberations. It was a time of change in the Senate, in the concept of our government, in the growth of the two-party system, in the spread of democracy to the farm and the frontier and in the United States of America. Men who were flexible, men who could move with or ride over the changing currents of public opinion, men who sought their glory in the dignity of the Senate rather than its legislative accomplishments, these were the men for such times. But young John Quincy Adams of Massachusetts was not such a man. John Quincy Adams. The young senator from Massachusetts stirred restlessly in his chair as the debate droned on. The half-filled Senate chamber fairly echoed with the shouting of his Massachusetts colleague, Senator Pickering, who was denouncing President Jefferson's trade embargo of 1807 for what seemed like the 100th time. Sorting the mail from Massachusetts, which lay in disarray on his desk, John Quincy Adams found his eye caught by an envelope with no return address. Inside was a single sheet of fine linen paper, and the senator grimly read its anonymous message a second time before crumpling letter and envelope into the basket by his desk. "Lucifer, son of the morning, how thou hast fallen! We hope not irrevocably. O Adams, remember who thou art. Return to Massachusetts. Return to thy country. Assist not in its destruction. Consider the consequences. Awake. Arouse in time. A Federalist." A Federalist? Adams mused bitterly over the word. Was he not the son of the last Federalist president? Had he not served Federalist administrations in the diplomatic service abroad? Had he not been elected as a Federalist to the Massachusetts legislature and then to the United States Senate? Now, simply because he had placed national interest before party and section, the Federalists had deserted him. Yes, he thought, I did not desert them, as they charge. It is they who have deserted me. My political prospects are declining, he wrote in his diary that night, and as my term of service draws near its close, I am constantly approaching to the certainty of being restored to the situation of a private citizen. For this event, however, I hope to have my mind sufficiently prepared. In the meantime, I implore that Spirit from whom every good and perfect gift descends to enable me to render essential service to my country, and that I may never be governed in my public conduct by any consideration other than that of my duty. These are not merely the sentiments of a courageous senator, they are also the words of a Puritan statesman. For John Quincy Adams was one of the great representatives of that extraordinary breed who have left a memorable imprint upon our government and our way of life. Harsh and intractable, the Puritan gave meaning, consistency, and character to the early days of the American Republic. His somber sense of responsibility towards his Creator, he carried into every phase of his daily life. He believed that man was made in the image of God, and thus he believed him equal to the extraordinary demands of self-government. The Puritan loved liberty, and he loved the law. He had a genius for determining the precise point where the rights of the state and the rights of the individual could be reconciled. In John Quincy Adams, these very characteristics were unhappily out of tune with the party intrigues and political passions of the day. Long before he had even entered the Senate, he had noted in his diary the dangers that confronted a Puritan entering politics. "I feel strong temptation to plunge into political controversy," he had written. "But a politician in this country must be a man of a party. I would fain be the man of my whole country." Few, if any, Americans have been born with the advantages of John Quincy Adams, a famous name, a brilliant father who labored unceasingly to develop his son's natural talents, and an extraordinary mother. Indeed, he was born with everything to make for a happy and successful life, except for those qualities that bring peace of mind. In spite of a life of extraordinary achievement, he was gnawed constantly by a sense of inadequacy, a frustration, a failure. Though his hard New England conscience and his remarkable talents drove him steadily along a road of unparalleled success, he had from the beginning an almost morbid sense of constant failure. Having served as a United States Senator, Harvard professor, and American minister to major European powers, he could write sadly in his diary, "I am 45 years old. 2/3 of a long life have passed, and I have done nothing to distinguish it by usefulness to my country and to mankind. Passions, indolence, weakness, and infirmities have sometimes made me swerve from my better knowledge of right and almost constantly paralyzed my efforts of good." And finally, at age 70, having distinguished himself as a brilliant Secretary of State, an independent president, and an eloquent member of Congress, he was to record somberly that his whole life had been a succession of disappointments. "I can scarcely recollect a single instance of success in anything that I have ever undertook." Yet the lifetime which was so bitterly deprecated by its own principle has never been paralleled in American history. John Quincy Adams, until his death at 80 in the Capitol, held more important offices and participated in more important events than anyone in the history of our nation. He figured, in one capacity or another, in the American Revolution, the War of 1812, and the prelude to the Civil War. Though one of the most talented men ever to serve his nation, he had few of the personal characteristics which ordinarily give color and charms to personality. But there is a fascination and nobility in this picture of a man judging himself more severely than his most bitter enemies judged him, and constantly driven onward by his conscience and his deeply felt obligation to be worthy of his parents, their example, and their precepts. It is significant to note that the two Adamses, father and son, were the only presidents not elected for a second term in the first 50 years of our nation's history. Yet their failures, if they can be called failures, were the result of their own undeviating devotion to what they considered to be the public interest and the result of the inability of their contemporaries to match the high standards of honor and rectitude that they brought to public life. The story of the son is not wholly separable from the story of the father, for John Quincy Adams was, as Samuel Eliot Morison has described him, above all an Adams, and his heartwarming devotion to his father and the latter's steadfast loyalty to his son, regardless of political embarrassment, offer a single ray of warmth in that otherwise hard, cold existence. As a child in a tightly knit Puritan family, John Quincy had been taught by his mother to emulate his famous father, and as a senator, when colleagues and friends deserted him on every side, it was to his father that he turned for support and approval. The failure of John Quincy Adams to recognize the political facts of life first became apparent during his years in the Senate, years which were neither the most productive of his life nor those in which his contribution was especially significant. Yet his single term in the United States Senate gives us a clear insight into the fate of a man who brought to the public service notable faculties, a respected name, and a singular ambition for the right. His experience illustrates, as does almost none other, that even this extraordinary equipment is not enough to succeed in American political life. It was not unnatural that John Quincy, returning to Boston after diplomatic service abroad upon his father's defeat for president by Thomas Jefferson, should become active in the affairs of his father's party. He admired the Federalists as the founders of the Constitution and a bulwark against French revolutionary influences. The young ex-diplomat was elected as a Federalist to the Massachusetts legislature. But while with one hand the legislature moved young John Quincy nearer his vision of service to the nation, with the other it rudely ripped through the fabric of his dreams and placed real and unpleasant obstacles in his path. For the jealous and antagonistic Timothy Pickering, who had been dismissed as Secretary of State by his father, was selected as Adams' senatorial colleague to fill a short-term vacancy. Neither Pickering nor Adams entertain any illusions about the former's bitter enmity towards the entire Adams family. As a well-known and powerful Federalist, Senator Pickering would be able to channel upon his young colleague all the dislikes and suspicions which the remaining Federalist senators had harbored for the independence showed by the senior Adams as president. Nor could he expect sympathy from Jefferson's Republican senators, who had recently completed a bitter campaign against his father and the alien and sedition laws which bore his approval, noting in his diary that the qualities of mind most peculiarly called for are firmness, perseverance, patience, coolness, and forbearance. John Quincy Adams, like any other Puritan gentleman, set out for Washington determined to meet the standards of self-discipline which he had imposed upon himself. Arriving in Washington, Adams promptly indicated his disregard for both party affiliations and customary freshman reticence. Although illness in the family had prevented him from arriving in time to vote on ratification of President Jefferson's treaty for the purchase of the Louisiana Territory, he promptly aroused a storm of controversy by becoming the only Federalist to support that precedent-shattering acquisition actively on the floor, and to vote for an $11 million appropriation to effectuate it. His democratic principles also caused him to fight administration measures for imposing a government and taxes upon the residents of the territory, thus incurring the opposition of his Republican colleagues as well. But with a vision of an America stretched to its continental limits, he regarded Jefferson's remarkable feat in excluding Napoleon from our boundaries while enriching our nation as far more important than the outraged astonishment of his Federalist colleagues. Concerned primarily with maintaining the hegemony of New England, they feared westward expansion would diminish the political and economic influence of the commercial cities of the Northeast, lower the value of eastern lands in which they were financially interested, and provide the Jeffersonians with a permanent majority in Congress. The young Federalist from Massachusetts, as though he were oblivious to their attitude, heaped fuel upon the fire.